Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. For the first time ever, Democrats are planning to hold hearings on Medicare for All. One of the hearings will focus on a bill that Representative Pramila Jayapal, a Democrat from Washington State, plans to introduce in a few weeks. She leads the Medicare for All caucus, which has 78 members, not counting the new members of Congress. And then Senator Bernie Sanders' Medicare for All Act has 16 Democratic co-sponsors. Polling indicates that public support for Medicare for All is somewhere between 58 and 70%. This is at a time when it's just now starting to get national coverage. So you can bet that those numbers will actually move once people start talking about how the system would work. And that's what we are discussing today. How would a Medicare system actually work? What would it look like? Today, we're joined by Lee Stanfield, a member of the Steering Committee of Health Over Profits for Everyone. Lee is also founder of Single Payer Now Tucson. Hope supports H.R. 676, the Expanded and Improved Medicare for All Act. Hi, Lee. Welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. We're also joined by Dr. Anna Malino, primary care pediatrician in San Francisco. Dr. Malino is past president of Physicians for a National Health Program, a single-issue organization advocating for a universal, comprehensive, single-payer national health program. Hi, Dr. Malino. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And Dr. Margaret Flowers is a pediatrician and national board advisor for Physicians for a National Health Program. Dr. Flowers is a coordinator with the Health Over Profit for Everyone campaign. On May 5th, 2009, eight activists, including Dr. Flowers, were arrested at a Senate Finance Committee hearing for the Affordable Care Act. Hi, Dr. Flowers. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me, Rose.
It's great to have you. It's been a while since you've been on, Dr. Flowers, and it's really amazing to think that you were all arrested. Gosh, it's been almost 10 years now. Eight of you were arrested at a Senate Finance Committee hearing for the Affordable Care Act. I kind of remember it like it was yesterday. Healthcare executives had a seat at the table, and you all stood up and said single payer is the only answer. Here we are almost 10 years later, and Democrats have finally agreed to hold hearings on Medicare for All. How significant is that?
It is very significant, and it actually points to the fact that the movement, which never stopped organizing before 2009 and after, is really gaining important momentum, and that this is really a critical time for us to keep pushing for national improved Medicare for All. We're seeing, as you mentioned, record numbers of members of Congress co-sponsoring the legislation, the creation of the Medicare for All caucus, and now the hearings that are coming. Unfortunately, these are not committees of jurisdiction for this particular legislation, but it's definitely a step forward and a sign that we need to keep pushing.
Dr. Malino, what would you add? How significant are these upcoming hearings?
I think extremely significant. I have to agree with Margaret. We've been fighting this fight for many, many years and with ups and downs throughout. In 2010, right around when Barack Obama was elected, we had high hopes that maybe he would allow us at the table, but unfortunately that was not to be, and so there was a setback. But I think that sadly, our healthcare system is getting worse and worse. More and more people are being left out, and it's getting more and more expensive. And so I think that this is being driven home to millions and millions of Americans that are now supporting what the solution is, which is improved and expanded Medicare for All, and which is embodied really in H.R. 676, which I'm sure we're going to be talking about today.
Yes, we definitely will. Lee, you are a longtime activist pushing for single-payer Medicare for All. What are your thoughts about the Democrats finally planning to hold hearings on this?
Well, I'm thrilled that they are. I do have some concerns about some of the Democratic leadership who do not seem to be... let's just say that some of them are making statements in the media that make it sound like they are not really on board with a true Medicare for All system. And so that's very disconcerting.
Right. And we'll talk about that later in the show. There are a couple articles. Here's one from Politico. Establishment looks to crush liberals on Medicare for All. The coalition that fought Obamacare repeal has fragmented as the party tries to follow through on campaign promises. So we'll talk about that later in the show. But I really want to start the show by talking about how this would work, because we're spending the entire month of January focusing on solutions. And let's talk about, I mean, this is a massive undertaking. Dr. Flowers, when we do shows about healthcare, just talking about the various options that people on Medicare have for their supplemental and what drug addition do they want? I mean, we could spend hours just talking about that. It is so complex, and it's designed to be so confusing for people. I finally, for the first time, have experience with Medicare because I'm helping a family member. And I didn't realize that a lot of doctors don't take Medicare, and it's still quite expensive. I mean, it's obviously great that it's there for people, but it's still expensive, even if you have Medicare.
Right. Well, you know, we've made our healthcare system incredibly complicated, and that's a big reason why we're pushing for a national improved Medicare for All system, because it would greatly simplify the system. You wouldn't need to figure out which insurance you need to get and get supplemental insurances. You wouldn't have out-of-pocket costs like copays and deductibles that make it difficult for people to afford healthcare. Recent report that showed 54% of people in the United States are either delaying or going without necessary healthcare because of the cost. Would actually, you know, create a universal system. Everyone is in it. All of the health professionals are in it, so you can choose where you want to go to get your care. And it would allow health professionals to focus on their patients and what their patients' needs are, instead of all of this paperwork that we currently have and fighting with insurance companies to be able to give the care that your patients need. It, you know, people like to say that this is going to be so difficult, but we're really in a much better position now than we were in 1965 when we passed Medicare and Medicaid. At that point, we did not have computers and we did not have a national healthcare system. We still created Medicare and Medicaid in 1 year, enrolled 19 million seniors into it using basically a card that they checked off a box, a paper card, and it's worked. It's had a very low overhead cost. Only 2% of Medicare's dollars go towards overhead, and the rest goes towards care. So now we have this national framework in place, and it's just a matter of expanding it to everyone, improving it so that it covers more than what our current system covers, including dental and vision and hearing and a lot of things that people need and they can't get right now. So it doesn't have to be complicated, and that's a big argument for single-payer health care.
Dr. Malino, Dr. Flowers just said that only 2% of Medicare dollars goes to overhead, and Physicians for a National Health Program, in almost all of their information, highlight the fact that what we're dealing with right now, over $500 billion in administrative savings would be realized by replacing today's inefficient multi-insurance payers with a single streamlined public payer. So we're talking about $500 billion in administrative savings. Is this every year?
Absolutely. And in addition to that, there would be $100 billion savings from negotiating with pharmaceutical companies, which is another huge drain in our system. So, yes, that's the amount of money that we would be saving every year. In fact, there was a recent publication from University of Massachusetts from the Political Economy Research Institute, also known as PERI, where they found that, in fact, Medicare for All, and this would be Senator Sanders' bill, not H.R. 676, which would have even greater savings. The Medicare for All Act would reduce healthcare spending by 10%. So that's really what we need to look at. In fact, what is expensive and unsustainable really is not transitioning to Medicare for All, but staying in the system that we have today. That is unsustainable and hugely expensive for each individual as well as for our society.
So the idea behind an improved and expanded Medicare for All system is that everything would be covered, because right now dental is not, in many plans vision is not. So everything would be covered. Is that the plan, Dr. Melano?
Well, when you say everything, it's
dental, vision.
So inpatient, outpatient, dental, vision, hearing, mental health, and actually in Bernie Sanders' bill would be reproductive health as well. There would be no carve outs as we have today. So the most important parts of our healthcare system, yes, would be covered, and so you wouldn't need to think, oh well, I can't have this procedure because it's not going to be covered by my insurance company, but because all necessary medical needs would be covered under Medicare for All, and we would have the money to be able to do that.
Okay, so let's talk about. Oh, sure, Lee, go ahead.
Yeah, I would just like to interject something there. Under HR 676, 100% of the cost of all long-term care services would be covered, mm-hmm. just like all the other medical services that you spoke about. But right now, we're still trying to find out if Senator Sanders' bill leaves long-term care under Medicaid, which the last time we saw anything about that text of that bill did. It was planning to leave it under Medicaid as it is now. And if it does, that would be something we would need to have changed so that it aligns with HR 676 as it stands now before any rewrite, because right now it covers that completely. But under the Sanders bill in the Senate, leaving them under Medicaid makes it is really a bad idea, because Medicaid has many failings. It's been underfunded for, you know, a long, long time. The main problems are that, unlike the federal budget, the law requires state budgets to be balanced. And since Medicaid is administered state by state, the states frequently cut their part of the funding to Medicaid in order to balance their budgets. And also, even the federal government, Medicaid is in the category of a federal welfare program, and thus it's in the federal welfare budget. Now, because of the stigma that some people have attached to anything with the label welfare, these particular budgets are more frequently raided by Congress when they're looking for money. So in addition, there's little or no oversight for these welfare budgets, and that leaves Medicaid wide open to the ravenous appetites of the privatized Medicaid managed care organizations. Currently, there's almost no oversight by either federal or state governments as to where the money is going or how much access to care is denied or diminished. Kaiser Health News published an article on this issue on October the 19th, if anybody wants to look that up. And Medicaid has now been completely privatized, so that means that much of its funding is not spent on actual medical services, but on the multiple layers of middlemen in the administration of the program, and in investor profits required by the commercial insurance companies and the ACOs that are involved. So that leaves even less money to pay for the actual medical services for a program that's already underfunded. So, and under Medicaid, the ACOs and HMOs, which is what make it up, also limit the choice of providers. They have these preferred provider networks, et cetera. And the ACOs and all are now using these recent schemes that were developed called value-based payment. And what they do, they were created to supposedly reduce healthcare costs, but they've failed to do that. It's been shown now that they are not doing that. And in fact, they financially punish the very providers who serve the poorest and sickest populations. And certainly Medicaid is that, because just to be eligible for Medicaid, you have to be impoverished. So we are really concerned that that leaving long-term care under Medicaid would be a really, really disastrous thing to do. And that's one of the reasons we really want to know what's in the rewrite of H.R. 676. Because the way it stands now, that would not be the case. We would not have long-term care left under Medicaid. It would cover it just like it does all the other services.
Lee Stanfield is a member of the Steering Committee of Health Over Profits for Everyone. They support H.R. 676, the Expanded and Improved Medicare for All Act. Dr. Anna Malino is primary care pediatrician in San Francisco and past president of Physicians for a National Health Program. They advocate for a comprehensive single-payer national health program. Dr. Margaret Flowers is a pediatrician and national board advisor for Physicians for a National Health Program. She was one of eight activists who were arrested on May 5th, 2009 at a Senate Finance Committee hearing for the Affordable Care Act. At that time, health insurance executives had a seat at the table, but doctors who advocated for single-payer or Medicare for all did not. And if you'd like to join us, today we are talking about what Medicare for all would actually look like and how it would work in real time. Imagine when you go to the doctor. I mean, my insurance just went up another, I think it was $30 a month. The copays are really high. I'm shocked when I get my bills because they're so incredibly high. And under Medicare for All, some form of Medicare for all of that would change. So what questions do you have about how this would work in practice and how it would be funded? 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Dr. Malino, we invited Representative Jayapal to join us, but she's traveling right now. Do you know anything about the bill that she's planning to introduce in a few weeks? Is it going to be based on H.R. 676, or is it going to be H.R. 676 with new information? Do you know?
No, sadly, we do not know. I think that she has been speaking with some representatives of the healthcare community, but personally, I don't know. I don't know if other people on the call are aware, but she has not made it public. And I think that that's one of the things that we as healthcare activists are demanding, is that she make this public and do this before she actually introduces it. It's really, really important. And just as Lee was saying, long-term care is a critical component of Medicare for All, which is included in H.R. 676 and not in the Senate bill. And so initially, I believe that she was trying to change H.R. 676 to look more like the Senate version. And I think that that would really be a mistake. Medicaid continues to be means tested, which means that you need to be able to prove your poverty in order to be able to qualify. And with individuals that have incomes that go up and down on a monthly basis, it means that people are in and out of Medicaid constantly. So it's a Band-Aid for our system right now, and we do not want to continue that. So definitely thank you, Lee, for bringing that up about long-term care.
Dr. Flowers, do you know what will be in Representative Jayapal's bill?
Well, we're working very hard to figure that out. Just for your listeners, a little bit of background, H.R. 676 was first introduced in 2003 by Congressman John Conyers, and it was based on something called the Physicians Working Group report that came out of Physicians for National Health Program that really outlined what a national improved Medicare for All system would look like. And let's remember that this is not an experiment. There are many countries, in fact, every wealthy country around the world has some sort of a universal system. It's the United States that's an outlier on this. And so when Congressman Conyers stepped down, Congressman Keith Ellison first took on H.R. 676, and then he stepped down and ran for Attorney General, and now we have Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal, who's agreed to take this up. She wanted to move out of what we call a framework bill that outlines what we want and put some more details into it. But those details are incredibly important, because as you start to change the language in the legislation, it may read so that it looks like one thing, but actually the interpretation of that is something else. And so it's crucial that before she introduces this bill, that people in the single-payer community know what's in it. And there have been some meetings. In fact, Dr. Adam Gaffney, who's the current president of Physicians for National Health Program, has seen a draft of it. But in order to see a draft with it, he had to agree not to share that. And so actually, I'll be having a meeting with Congresswoman Jayapal's health staffer on Thursday. And in preparation for the meeting, I asked for a copy of the legislation so that I could look at it. And she said that she would only reveal certain sections of it if I agreed not to show them. And our response was that that's not acceptable. This is something that's going to impact everyone. It's going to be the bill for the next 2 years. Everyone needs to see it. We've been asking people to call into her office and press her to release the text of that. We do hear that initially she was starting to use the Senate bill as more of a model until she got a lot of pushback on that. One thing that we understand that she's including, but again we have to see the language, is that she's allowing the for-profit providers to continue to operate in the system. This is a problem because the for-profit providers are the ones that are the most expensive and that have poor outcomes because they try to cut corners, they may provide, you know, services that aren't necessary, or they may cut back on services that are necessary so that they can move a lot of people through the system. And so this is absolutely the wrong kind of incentive or practice that we want to have in our current healthcare system. And that's what we call our campaign Health Over Profit, because we're really trying to make health the bottom line of our system, not private profits for a few. So I encourage people to call Congresswoman Jayapal's office and urge her to release that text. And we're going to keep doing everything we can to see that text and share it out widely. There shouldn't be anything to hide here.
Representative Jayapal was on.
Add something.
I just wanted to mention, Lee, quickly. Representative Jayapal was on MSNBC over the weekend, saying that she's going to introduce the legislation in the next couple of weeks. So now is definitely a time to call. Sorry about that. Go ahead, Lee.
Oh, I wanted to just let people know that they can. The numbers for reaching her by phone. Her Seattle office is 206-674-0040. Her D.C. office is 202-225-3106.
Thank you.
And then also I wanted to elaborate a little bit on what Dr. Flowers was saying about allowing for-profits to stay in the system. One of the major concerns about the Senate Medicare for All bill is that it has some conflicting sections that seem to conflict with one another. But from what we can tell, it seems to contain some provisions that will allow ACOs, that's accountable care organizations, to continue to exist permanently. And that's a big problem because accountable care organizations, they're one of the managed care type of organizations, very similar to HMOs, and they were originally created to supposedly to try to control cost in the USA's commercialized system. Ironically, the formal definition of accountable care organization has remained vague, which conveniently allows the designers of the systems to avoid their own accountability for a very flawed concept. Those who have delved into this issue and really looked at it say that basically ACOs are groups of providers who take on all or part of the financial risk that's usually the responsibility of an insurance company. ACOs are funded by the same method as insurance companies. It's called capitation, and it works the same way insurance premiums work. That is that the ACO is paid a set amount per patient per year to cover all services for that patient for the year. Now, that's regardless of what the cost of providing those services turn out to be. So if they end up having to spend less on patients than the amount given them for the year, they get to keep the difference or a portion of the difference depending on their contract with their funders. But if the patient needs if a patient's health needs require more money than was allocated, then the ACO loses money. So this way of funding, this which is called capitation, gives both insurance companies and ACOs a financial incentive to cut back on patient services and staffing and employee wages, et cetera, regardless of patient needs, just so they don't lose money at the end of the year. So, and unfortunately, one side effect of that is that with capitation, those who serve the most needy are penalized the most. And the reason is because accountable care organizations, ACOs, are held accountable through what are called value-based payment plans, which are also known as pay-for-performance plans. These funding strategies have failed to provide either the higher quality or the lower cost that those who designed them claimed they would achieve. But what they do is financially reward or punish providers based on a very crude measure of cost and quality of services, subjective measures, which ignore numerous factors that providers have no control over. So providers are being judged on things that they have no control over, such as patient's income,
Lee, sorry to cut you off, but we have to take a quick break. And after the break, I would like to ask you, well, I really want to try to stick with solutions because, I mean, inevitably we have to talk about how the system works now. And there's so many layers to this, but I really would like to focus on how this would actually work so people can start talking about it. But we also, of course, we have to talk about what happens to the health insurance companies. I mean, this is going to be a fight. According to FierceHealthcare.com, health insurance CEOs brought home $342 million in 2017. So this is definitely going to be a fight. That is Lee Stanfield, member of the steering committee of Health Over Profits. Dr. Anna Malino is a primary care pediatrician in San Francisco and past president of Physicians for a National Health Program. And Dr. Margaret Flowers is a pediatrician and national board advisor for Physicians for a National Health Program. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Tomorrow we continue our series on solutions by talking about what it will take to get money out of politics. What can we do to overturn Citizens United and get real campaign finance reform? And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, yourcall@kalw.org. You can also listen to past shows and podcast the show, yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about what Medicare for All would actually look like. For the first time ever, Democrats, House Democrats, are planning to hold hearings on Medicare for All. And Senator Bernie Sanders' Medicare for All Act has 16 Democratic co-sponsors. This is definitely going to be an issue in the presidential debates, especially on the Democratic side. Today, we're speaking with Lee Stanfield, member of the Steering Committee of Health Over Profits for Everyone and founder of Single Payer Now Tucson. Dr. Anna Malino is a primary care pediatrician in San Francisco and past president of Physicians for a National Health Program. Dr. Margaret Flowers is a pediatrician and national board advisor for Physicians for a National Health Program. Dr. Flowers was arrested on May 5th, 2009, at a Senate Finance Committee hearing for the Affordable Care Act. And if you'd like to join us, if you have questions about this, just envisioning what Medicare for All would look like. That's what I really want to talk about today. How would that work? How would it be funded? 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Lisa couldn't stay on the line, but she had a question. Under Medicare for All, what would happen to people on Medicaid, which is terrible? Would they be upgraded to Medicare? Bill also had a similar question. If we had a true Medicare for All system, wouldn't that mean we no longer need Medicaid? Dr. Flowers, do you want to take that first?
Sure. Yeah, it would actually mean that we wouldn't need Medicaid or any of the many other types of insurances that we have. The United States has a very complicated healthcare system because we have so many different pieces of it, and so we can't create a single system that actually can get the efficiencies of being a single system and save money. So every person from the time that you're born until the time that you die would be in the healthcare system, the national health insurance. And it would be paid for up front through taxes, all of your necessary care would be covered, as Dr. Malino explained, including things that aren't typically covered now, like vision, dental, hearing, mental health, and all health professionals would be in it. So people can go where they want to go. They can choose their health professional. If you're traveling around the country and you have a health problem, you are covered. If you have an unusual problem, health problem, and there's a specific hospital or medical center that deals with that problem, then you can go to that health center because it's in the network. So it just creates one nationwide health insurance, and everybody's in it.
And I'd just like to add that the only reason people keep talking about how much it costs, well, the only reason that taxes would go up is because all of your out-of-pocket expenses, including premiums and copays and coinsurance or prescription costs, any of that would be switched over to being paid for through taxes. But these taxes would be sliding scale taxes based on your income. So you would only pay according to what you can afford, and those who cannot afford to pay at anything will still be covered. Everyone will be covered, and actually it will be saving hundreds of billions of dollars on a nationwide basis. So it's really misleading for anyone to say that your taxes will go up if we get a single-payer Medicare for All system. It's not that the taxes are going up on top of everything you're paying now. It means that you do away with all that you're paying now, and it just switches over to being paid through taxes.
Dr. Malino, what else would you add about how this would be funded and how the tax structure would work?
So most people in this country would see a decrease in the amount of money that they're currently paying to pay for health, for their healthcare costs. Lee is absolutely right. When we talk about how much money we each individually pay into the healthcare system, it's about $27,000 per family per year for a family of four that is in a PPO. So the $27,000 is what the employer pays for the premium, what the employee pays for the premium, plus the out-of-pocket costs, which are significant, and those are paid every single year. And so $27,000, that's a huge chunk of people's income, and the employer's amount is significant as well. So under a single-payer system that is publicly funded and privately delivered, the funding would be equitable through taxes according to people's means. And so the study that I referred to previously from the University of Massachusetts actually did break down what that would look like, and that the vast majority of individuals would be paying anywhere from anything like 4 to 14% less in healthcare costs every year. And the top 20% would see a small rise in the percent of taxes that they pay, and then the top 5% would see a little bit more significant increase, but still only 4.7% of their income. That's less than 5% of what they're paying right now. So I think that overall, it's when you look at what most people are paying right now, it's a much more equitable and fair distribution of our wealth to have a single payer system, and for the country as a whole, we would see cumulative savings where we would actually be able to save money and put money where we need to put money in healthcare, not in high salaries for CEOs, which, as you just mentioned, are in the billions of dollars every year. That's not where our healthcare dollars should be going.
Dr. Malino, people who are not in a family of four may have raised their eyebrows when you said average costs are about $27,000 a year. Mm-hmm. But every time we do shows about health care, we just did one about a month ago, and some people, when they go online to see what bronze, gold plan they can get, I mean, we're talking about $500 a month, in some cases even higher, $800, $1,200 mm-hmm. for a family of four. The Atlantic has a good piece out about out-of-pocket spending, and it found that even with employer-provided health insurance, out-of-pocket spending has increased by more than 50% since 2010. Mm-hmm. And the Kaiser Family Foundation found that in 2016, half of all insurance policyholders faced a deductible of at least $1,000. For people who buy their insurance via the ACA, 90% have deductibles of $1,300 for an individual or $2,600 for a family. So your $27,000 number, that's right on target, but right. It just sounds so incredibly high.
Well, but and it's true. I mean, our entire healthcare system is so bloated with expenses, and the problem is that it's very expensive and it underperforms, because at the end of the day, when we compare our healthcare outcomes to other countries that have universal healthcare, that have single payer system, we really do not compare quite so well. Our infant mortality is higher, our maternal mortality is higher, our life expectancy is lower. So for all the money that we're spending, we're just not really getting our money's worth.
Dr. Flowers, anything else you want to add about payment? Because we're getting a lot of emails about how this would work financially.
Yeah, I'd like to add something to that.
So, Dr. Flowers, go ahead, and then Lee.
Great, thank you. So one thing I think it's important to understand is that our current healthcare system is designed in a way that's very unique. Other countries don't design their healthcare systems this way at all. But in the United States, you're only able to get healthcare if you can afford it. So the sicker someone is, the higher their healthcare costs are. So if you don't have money to pay for that surgery, you don't get it. If you don't have money to pay for your prescriptions like insulin or other life-saving medications, you don't get it. In other countries that have universal healthcare systems, you pay in up front. Like Dr. Malino explained, there's a simple tax. It's based on your income. It's predictable. You know every year what you're going to be expected to pay. And no matter what happens to you, if you need to get care, if you have a major accident and go to a trauma center, you don't have to worry about, can I afford to get the care that I need? You can just go in that and get that care. We see too many stories where, you know, people have an accident and the first thing they say is, please don't call an ambulance. I can't afford it. And that's, to me, that's just, it's really cruel. It's the way that we ration healthcare in the United States. We ration it by cost. Other countries make decisions based on their needs and their resources. But we don't do that at all. And another thing that, that Anna kind of mentioned or alluded to is, you know, in the United States, we have so many hospitals that are closing because they can't afford to stay open. They don't make, quote-unquote, enough profit. And under a single-payer National Improved Medicare for All system, each hospital would get a budget of money, an operating budget that they use to take care of their population. They don't have to worry about fighting with insurance companies to get the money or if they're going to have enough money to take care of their population. They can just actually focus on the population. They don't have to count every Band-Aid. Instead, you know, it's a waste of nurses' time to be having to keep track of every single pill, every little thing that they distribute. That's taking away from their direct patient time, their patient care time. And so, you know, right now in rural areas, some people have to travel over 100 miles to get to a hospital, and that's also causing poor outcomes. You know, if a mother goes into labor, she has to worry about whether she can get to a hospital. If somebody has an emergency, like a heart attack, can they get there in time to get care? So this would have a lot of important impacts on improving the health of our population. And in fact, our life expectancy is declining now. This is the third year in a row, and it's the first time that we've had this type of decline since the 1960s. And the organizations that track this say that a large part of our decline in life expectancy is because we don't have a functional healthcare system.
Dr. Flowers, Wendy in San Francisco writes, what about seniors who have paid into Medicare their whole lives? Will they be taxed the same as others? And she's talking about seniors today.
Right. Well, seniors, I mean, if they have an income, they continue to pay into the Medicare system. If you're not paying taxes, then you don't have to worry about, you know, paying into the system. But this is going to be a huge improvement for seniors. I think this is important for people to understand, is that seniors currently have to get supplemental plans, and so they have to pay for those. They need to get prescription plans. They don't have coverage for many of the things like dental care or vision or hearing. And so under this system, they seniors would have all of that, and also importantly is the long-term care. A very small percentage of seniors in the United States have long-term care insurance, and even when they use it, they find that often it doesn't cover what they need. And so currently, many seniors have to spend down their assets until they're in poverty, and then once they're in poverty, they can qualify to get long-term care under Medicaid. And as Lee said, it's underfunded, and so the facilities are not as high quality as they should be. So long-term care would be included in this system, and that would give seniors a lot of security and comfort knowing they don't have to worry.
Well, let's take a few callers back to back, and then we'll get you all to respond because they've been waiting patiently. Let's go to Ruthann in El Cerrito. Hi, Ruthann. Welcome to the show.
Hi there. I had a question which was based on, and I wouldn't know the funding mechanism. Instead of Medicare for All, if there could be a system that would be Medicaid for All, because Medicaid pays for long-term care, and it also pays for prescriptions, and it also pays for dental, and all the things that Medicare, which I have as a person with a disability, does not pay for. I do get my prescriptions through a plan in California, SB 393, that ensures that any prescription I get has to, that I'm paying out of pocket for, because I don't have a Medicare Part D plan, the pharmacy has to charge me the Medicaid price. And there's a huge, huge, huge difference. And I was just thinking that Medicaid covers way more than Medicare in the gaps that Medicare does not pay for. And I didn't know if in the improved and expanded Medicare for All, if my coining it as Medicaid for All is in any way applicable or feasible.
Can I address that? I'm being a senior.
Sure. Go ahead, Lee.
Yes, you would be much better off under an improved Medicare, improved expanded Medicare for All. You would not need Medicaid. Yes, Medicaid right now may cover more things, but it doesn't cover them adequately. The quality is not there, and sometimes, and besides, you have to be impoverished to even be eligible. Medicare for All, which is actually, Medicare used to be better than it is now, frankly. Mm-hmm. Every year that goes by, Congress does something more to basically privatize and underfund and whatever. And so Medicare has a lot of things lacking in it now that need to be addressed. And that's why we try to make sure that people understand that we would not just be giving everybody in the nation Medicare as it is now. It will be including all of the things that Medicaid covers now, plus things that Medicaid doesn't cover, and doing it in a much higher quality manner. And you will not have to become impoverished to be covered. Everyone will be covered the same, regardless of whether you have any income or not. And one of the things I'd like to mention is
Lee, we're almost out of time, and we have so many people who've been waiting patiently. Let me just take a couple more calls, and then we can get responses. We're going to have to do several shows on this because it's such a huge topic. Let's go to Julie in San Francisco. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Rose. Thank you for taking my call. I just had two questions. One is I'm curious what the general physician population thinks about Medicare for All. I came in late, but I don't think they talked about that. And, I mean, would they make less money? That kind of thing. And then the second question is it the thought that eventually this would evolve into kind of a two-care system where the people who can afford it, there would be some sort of private system as well, or a concierge system, like, you know, that has evolved in so many other countries that have a national healthcare system. So I'll take my things off the air. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. We have concierge doctors here in the U.S. Dr. Malino, do you want to take that?
I would love to. These are two great questions, and thank you, Julie, for asking. So regarding the general physician population, there was a Medscape poll just done last month, December 18th, that asked physicians, do you favor or oppose the U.S. moving to a single-payer healthcare system? And in fact, 68% of the U.S. healthcare professionals supported. Of those, the 66% of physicians actually supported. And there was a previous poll some years back that showed that this was in 2005, I believe, that in fact showed that even at that point, close to 60% of physicians supported government legislation for Medicare for All. So it's right up there just with the general population as far as support for Medicare for All. So rest assured that physicians are just as unhappy with the healthcare system as the general population is. And then as far as going to a two-care system, I think that that is something that you really have to work against, because we do not want two-care system, two-tiered system, right, which we have right now. Of course, right now we have probably more like a five-tiered system. Going to a two-tiered system might actually be an improvement, but it's something that you do need to caution against, and that's why I think that the legislation is so critical as to how it is written. And H.R. 676, and I believe even the Senate bill, although I'm not 100% sure of Sanders' bills, but the H.R. 676 does specifically prohibit physicians from gaming the system and being part of two systems. Whenever you do that, you really run the risk of depleting the resources of your public system, because then resources, particularly physicians, then go from one system to another system where they might be better compensated, and then you leave the public system open for longer waiting times and so forth. So it's really critical that we make sure that we fight very, very strongly to have one system where everybody's in and nobody is out. And that's the beauty, really, of Medicare, is that there is a solidarity among seniors, because they do want to fight for their own system. And once you're 65, it's your right in the United States, if you've paid into Social Security, to be eligible for Medicare. And that's the biggest difference between Medicare and Medicaid. Medicaid, as I said, is means tested. You have to prove your poverty, and then you game the system. So it actually locks people into poverty, because the minute that they make one more dollar over that criteria, then they can no longer be eligible for Medicaid, and so they go off this fiscal cliff. So Medicare for all, really, everybody in, nobody out, is really what we want, and we want the network of physicians where everybody is in and nobody is out either. But thank you for the question.
All right. Thank you so much for that, Julie. And let's go next to Carolyn in Oakland. Hi, Carolyn.
Hi, Rose. Thank you for having this show. It's wonderful. We need to talk more about this thing that should be happening now. You know, as you probably know, I only jumped on about a half hour ago, but 72% of the population, when they voted in November, healthcare was their number one issue. 70% of the population believes that Medicare for All, we should have that system. And I'm with National Nurses United, and we're planning some events to promote and to push and to organize constituents to call their representatives to get them to sign on to this bill. Last year it had 116 co-sponsors, and it needs to have that and more. And also there's a Medicare for All caucus, and we need to have everybody jump in on that too. So we're organizing barnstorms across the nation, February 9th through 13th. You can visit our website, Medicare4all.org, and find out where there's one near you. And in San Francisco, there'll be a barnstorm where we're going to organize folks to call and canvass in Nancy Pelosi's district. We need to get her on board, and that's going to be February 12th at the Women's Building at 6 p.m. So I know there's folks in San Francisco listening to this, so please join us. And you can visit our website to find out more, because now is the time. We need to move this.
Now,
we have that opportunity. So thank you so much for taking my call and let me share this.
Karen, thank you so much, and we've got information up about that. Final thoughts from all of you. She mentioned Speaker Pelosi. She was on MSNBC saying that she really wants to improve the ACA, and she kind of left it at that. They didn't elaborate much. But according to Common Dreams, former Obama and Clinton campaign officials and establishment Democrats are already crafting their talking points and formulating strategies to undercut Medicare for All. So we're going to have this, and we're going to have the hearings. Lee, just quickly, we don't have much time left. What's the most effective way for people to get involved in this?
Well, I think by going to the HOPE website, the PNHP website. You have those listed. You have those out there for people?
Yes.
Do you have those out there for people, Laura?
We do. Hello? It's yourcallradio.org.
Okay. And by calling Representative Pramila Jayapal at the numbers that I mentioned before and insisting on full transparency of any rewrite of H.R. 676 and on the inclusion of long-term care services in the single-payer aspect of the system, not under Medicaid, and total exclusion of commercial insurance like HMOs and ACOs and Advantage plans, and elimination of all those value-based payment schemes that actually just punish providers who are serving the most needy patients.
Dr. Malino,
contact your
Lee. Sorry, Lee, we're almost out of time. Dr. Malino, brief final thoughts.
Absolutely. It's critical that people understand that there's a difference between improved and expanded Medicare for All and everything else that many of the Democrats are going to try to be pushing, such as the Medicare Advantage, which are privatized Medicare plans, Medicare for All, Medicare Advanced Public Option, Medicare Advantage, and the ACA exchanges. This is all no Medicare for them. It's really, really important that people understand the difference and that we fight for an improved and expanded Medicare for All.
And Dr. Flowers, brief final thoughts.
Yep, very simple. If you want good information on the policy, go to Physicians for National Health Program, PNHP.org. And if you want tools for activism and to plug in to kind of the activist part, go to the healthoverprofit.org website. Specifically, if you're new, go to the welcome section. It will walk you through how you can get involved. There's something that everyone can do, and it's going to be necessary for all of us to get involved and push this for us to win and fight against these fake plans, as Dr. Malino alluded to. So we can do this. We're in a very good position, and this is a time to be fighting for it.
Dr. Margaret Flowers, Dr. Anna Malino, and Lee Stanfield, thank you all so much for joining us. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.